Welcome to another edition of Mormonland. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce, and I oversee the Salt Lake Tribune's faith coverage. I'm joined again by senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
The Mormon History Association's just completed annual conference offered the usual smorgasbord of delectable scholarly presentations relating to Mormonism. The 2021 theme for the hybrid in-person and online meeting in Park City, Utah was Restoration, Reunion, and Resilience. There were sessions on polygamy and early experiences in Nauvoo and Kirtland, along with discussions of race, LGBTQ issues, and a recognition that the historians were meeting in the ancestral lands of several northern bands of the Ute Indian tribe. Here to share highlights from the three-day gathering are Barbara Jones Brown, the association's executive director, and Jenny Lund, this year's president and director of the church's historic sites. They join us today via Zoom. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Dave.
We're glad to have you with us. So, Barbara, let me start with you. Tell us how hard it was to organize in this meeting during a pandemic, even though we're sort of getting hopefully to the back end of it.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we had to cancel entirely an in-person conference last year. We were supposed to meet in Rochester/Palmyra, New York last year to commemorate the 200th anniversary of Joseph Smith's professed first vision. But of course, we had to cancel because we were in the throes of the pandemic. We did kind of a small scale online conference, but didn't do much last year. Rescheduled the Rochester conference for this year, but then as we were getting close to it again, we realized it's not going to happen in Rochester again. I was so sad to have to cancel another conference for a second time in a row, but I happen to live in Park City, Utah, and right above my neighborhood is the Utah Olympic Park, the two big ski jumps, if you've ever been to Park City.
With the big pool, yes, that they jump into.
The big swimming pool. And I had been up there because my daughter works there, and I drove up, and I thought, I wonder if we could turn this kind of outdoor venue into a conference center for our conference so that it would be safer during the pandemic and so forth. We made it work. Turns out, by the time the conference happened, the CDC guidelines and Utah guidelines and the site's guidelines had changed. If you were vaccinated, we didn't have to wear masks. And so most of us there were not wearing masks because we were vaccinated. And it was actually turned out to be a phenomenal spot. All of the historians loved seeing all the ski jumpers, the Olympians who are training for the Olympics, doing all kinds of crazy jumps into the pool. Mm-hmm. And so it turned out to be great. But we also did, for the first time in MHA's history, a hybrid conference. We had folks who were there presenting in person, which we also recorded and live streamed and made available online. And the exciting thing about this is that people can continue to enjoy the conference throughout the year. If they missed sessions they weren't able to go to in person, they can do that. And those who weren't able to join us in person can go to MormonHistoryAssociation.org, register for the conference, and then watch all of the sessions that we're going to be talking about today. And there are some phenomenal sessions. Because we were digital, we had people presenting from all over the world. We had people there from Brazil, from Russia, from South Africa, from Europe, various places in Europe. And we had people watching from all over the world. So we really hope this is one silver lining of COVID, is that we have learned how to do hybrid conferences, and we hope and plan from going forward from here that we will always have these digital offerings every year after, during MHA conference with the live streaming and then recordings afterwards.
So what were your numbers like, Barbara? How many were actually there? And do you have any idea what your numbers were, that watched virtually so far?
So in terms of in-person, we capped our numbers at 400 because of the pandemic. We wanted to keep things a little bit smaller, and that's what the site could also accommodate. We had 376 people registered to come in person, and then we have over 200 who have, in addition, have signed up for the online-only version. We hope we've got a whole year to continue to watch the digital conference, so I hope to have hundreds more come and watch digitally.
So, Jenny, tell us about your presidential address. What was the topic in your thesis?
So my presidential address focused on some letters that I have been editing with a friend of mine for publication. And we drew one, I drew one chapter of that manuscript, which is about a Latter-day Saint missionary wife in the 19th century and her constant fear, overwhelming fear, that her husband is going to bring home another wife from his mission. So it's a really fascinating little picture. The letters are so candid so detailed that you're able to kind of follow this story a little bit reading between the lines of her letters. But she, of course, lives in a culture which is really has plural marriage examples all around her. She grew up in a polygamous household. And but from the letters, you can see that she is really adverse to this. And every time a missionary marries a woman that he met on his mission, it just brings this fear home to her. And she talks about, I am not considered much of a polygamist. And sometimes her critiques, she can be really funny. So she'll tease her husband over this topic a little bit. And then at other times she can be really biting. And so it's just really this really fascinating window into the experience of one Latter-day Saint woman. Her name was Sarah Peterson Lund. She was married to a man who later became quite prominent, Anton H. Lund, who later became a member of the Quorum of the Twelve and the First Presidency. The end of the story is that her husband, although he's a very Orthodox Latter-day Saint and he's up and coming leader in the church, he never becomes a polygamist. He remains a monogamist all of his life. And I think that in the end was quite a surprise to her because she was fully expecting that he would enter plural marriage.
I was going to ask you what the end of the story was, whether he brought home another wife or not. So thank you. Thank you for that spoiler. Okay, so Jenny and Barbara, can you tell us some of the standout sessions that people are going to be talking about for a long time? Barbara, maybe you go first and then Jenny.
There were so many. I'll just highlight a few and then Jenny can highlight ones that stood out for her. Dave kind of mentioned this at the beginning, but we opened, there's kind of two openings to the conference. First was Thursday night. We had an opening welcoming plenary. And this year it was on the Mark Hoffman case and the murder of Among the Mormons recent Netflix documentary. So the reason why we did this was 35 years ago in 1986 at MHA, there was an opening plenary session at the time, a lot of the historians still didn't believe that Hoffman was a forger of these documents or that he had committed these horrendous murders. And so there was a session and they were talking about these recent documentary finds, as they were calling them at the time. And I put together a panel. This was 35 years later now in 2021, talking about what it was called back then. It was called the Document Diggers and Their Discoveries, MHA 1986. And then I said, versus the Con Man and His Forgeries, MHA 2021. And if you've seen Murder Among the Mormons, we had all of the many of the participants in that documentary, many of the historians participate in this panel, including the directors Jared Hess and Tyler Meesom. Everyone from Sandra Tanner to Alan Roberts, who wrote Salamander, to Rick Turley, who wrote Victims. And I just asked each of them, oh, and two of the folks who had been on that 35-year panel 35 years ago were also participants, Jeff Johnson, who was an archivist, and Alan Roberts, who wrote Salamander. So we talked about the documentary, what the historians felt like the documentary filmmakers got wrong and what they felt like they got right, and how the Hoffman case has shaped history and how we do Mormon history and indeed American history over the last 35 years. So that was what we opened up with. It was really interesting. Very, very, I mean, it's tragic, of course. It's a tragic story, But with people like Jared Hess on the panel, there was a lot of funny moments as well. So I encourage people, you can go online and watch that. Another highlight for me was the next morning when we officially opened the conference, and Dave mentioned this, but P. Jane Hafen, who is a member of MHA's board and Taos Pueblo Indian, she gave a land acknowledgement, recognizing that we were meeting on the backdrop of the history of the Ute people whose lands, ancestral lands we were meeting on, and acknowledged that, presented a gift to Forrest Kutch, a Ute tribal elder and former executive director of the Indian Affairs Division for the state of Utah. And then Forrest told us about the history of the Ute people in the area and their interactions with Mormon settlers when they arrived. And then following Forrest, we had Sandra Morrison, who is a local Park City historian and former director of the Park City Historical Society. She taught us about the overall history, settler history of Park City. So that was a really interesting session to open with. Jenny, do you want to jump in? And then we can kind of maybe go back and forth a little so I'm not talking too much.
Sure. I think one of the remarkable things about this year's MHA was the number of sessions that were on issues surrounding race, number of sessions about indigenous peoples and blacks and various issues and various stories there. I think a couple that stand out for me were a session on a book. It's actually often we have a session that focuses on a particular book that was published during the last year or 18 months. And so there was a session that was on essays on American Indian and Mormon history that was edited by Brendan Rensink and P. Jane Hafen. This is a book that came out of a workshop that was done at the Charles Redd Center at Brigham Young University, looking at Native Americans and Latter-day Saint history. And it tried to that workshop tried to turn the tables on how we look at Native Americans by looking from their perspective. So they were the subject of these stories rather than being kind of the object of action by Latter-day Saint settlers. So it was really a fascinating approach. And this panel brought together probably six or seven of the authors of those essays. And in addition to talking about the essay they wrote, they really often talked about their personal connection to the story that stories that they were trying to tell. So you learned a lot of really fascinating things about some of these scholars, and you learned some fascinating stories. And you always sit there and say, well, I didn't know that before. So something new that I learned was that a lot of Pacific Islander missionaries were sent to the Navajo reservation over the years. And so there is a really strong connection between Pacific Islanders. Many of those Pacific Islanders have moved to the towns right around the Navajo or on the Navajo reservation. And there is this really strong cultural interaction between those groups. That's something I had no clue about.
Was that purposeful, Jenny? Is they sent them for a reason? Did they see there's some tie-in or something like that? Or
no, not necessarily. Huh. Yeah, and I think and another session I found really fascinating. It was one that was about biography, which is always interesting. I really like biographies. But one of those sessions or one of the papers was by Amy Tanner. I'm not sure how to say her last name. Thuriot, I think. Thuriot, Amy Tanner Thuriot, mm-hmm. where she talked about stories of family history stories about early Latter-day Saint slave owners or enslavers and how they have over the years, their family histories have changed those stories to make it much more palatable that their ancestors owned slaves. They often have stories about how, oh, yes, we did in the South, but after we joined the church, we released all those. We gave them all their freedom. And the reality is she took those stories one by one of early Latter-day Saint families and showed that those stories are false. And it was really a fascinating revelation to me.
Can I ask about the association established an Artist E. Parshall Public History Award? Can you talk a little bit about that, Barbara? Maybe that's you, the genesis of that honor. Artist is, of course, a beloved historian and has been on Mormonland several times.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you touched on this, because this was definitely a highlight of the entire conference at our awards ceremony. A little less than a year ago, I had Heather Stone, who is an MHA member, approach me, and she noticed that in MHA's awards, we don't give any awards for public history. And she said, would you be interested in starting a public history award? I said, absolutely. And she said, I'll put up $5,000, which was fantastic, a matching grant, if you can raise the other $5,000, which we did through many, many MHA members making donations anywhere from $20 up to $1,000. So we were able to raise that and permanently endow this award. And then Heather was saying to me, well, should we name it after somebody? And I said, sure. And I said, let's name it after somebody. And then we kind of brainstormed. And I said, how about Artist Parshall? And she said, oh, Artist Parshall, absolutely. She's the one we need to name it after, because she's actually the one who inspired me to come up with this award. And anyone who knows Artist Parshall and her work at Keep a Pitchin' In and Century of Black Mormons, so many venues, knows what fantastic work she does as a public historian. And so the thing that was really exciting is not only did we name the award after her this year, we also gave her the inaugural award, which she didn't know she was going to receive. So it was a very emotional moment, and everyone jumped to their feet, gave her a standing ovation. It was quite emotional. And then the first award they gave it to, the first official award they gave it to, was Better Days 2020. And I used to serve as historical director of Better Days 2020, but I had nothing to do with the decision. I only nominated it along with several other public history projects that others nominated as well. And the committee independently chose to give it to Better Days 2020, which is also very deserving. You can check out their work on their website, Google them, and they've done phenomenal work in making increasing awareness of Utah women's role in the suffrage movement and Utah women's role in activism. Hmm. So that was a highlight, and we are so excited now that award is permanently endowed in Artist's name. And going forward, we will continue to give that public history award every year, along with our book and article awards.
So what were your book awards this year?
So there were a bit unusual this year is that we had a tie. So we had two winners for Best Book Award. The first one went to Benjamin Park for his book, Kingdom of Nauvoo. I think that's the title. A wonderful book on the history of the church in Nauvoo in the 1840s. Really kind of sets a new way of looking at that story, and had the advantage of using the Joseph Smith papers to help frame that, and especially the Council of 50 Minutes, which is the first kind of full volume that really uses those minutes to their best advantage in a reinterpretation. The other award went to Taylor Petrie for his book, and Barbara's going to have to help me with the title of that. I don't remember the exact wording.
It was Tabernacles of Clay.
That's right. And
sorry, Petrie, I forgot the exact subhead, but it's about the history of Mormon sexuality and gender in the Mormon faith.
We can tell our listeners, we had Ben Park on and Taylor on to talk about their various books. So, yeah, so if you go back and search that, you'll be able to find those past episodes.
So, Barbara, I heard about a session that had to do with DNA and how that kind of disrupted a family situation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Actually, Jenny should talk about this, because Jenny was in that session.
Okay. Jenny?
Yeah. So that was a really fascinating session. And that paper in particular was by a BYU Law School professor, Kif Augustine Adams. And it was partially history and contextualization, but it was more importantly, it ended up really being memoir, because it was about her own experience. and the fact that she had taken, or I think her daughter took a DNA test, is doing family history and connecting, and discovered that Kif had a sister, a half-sister that she didn't know about. And that half-sister was the product of a rape that her mother had never spoken about to anyone. And so what she does is she looks, using this story in her own experience, she looks at this challenge of Latter-day Saints who engage in family history, and all of a sudden we have this new technology that allows us to find DNA evidence to link us to our ancestors. It can be a great blessing, but it also comes with this real fraught possibility that you can have discover something you weren't expecting, how traumatic that can be for not only you, but for multiple family members. And what are the implications of this? So it was a really fascinating paper, and she put it in context of American culture at the time. This incident happened in 1959, and church culture at the time, and how her mother really suffered as her mother, the victim, yet was blamed by so many people, by her family, by the church leaders that she met with for having a part in this sin.
So, Jenny, I'm going to have you wear your other hat a little bit, too, as a director of church historic sites. The church historian, LeGrand Curtis, made an announcement during the conference about an effort the church is undertaking on the Hill Cumorah. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The Elder Curtis announced that the Hill Cumorah will be undergoing a major, what we call a rehabilitation project over the next couple of years. As you and your listeners will know, the pageant, the Hill Cumorah pageant, which had been going on for 80 years, the First Presidency decided to discontinue that pageant permanently. And over the years, over those 80 years, more and more infrastructure has been added to the Hill Cumorah to support that major theatrical production. And our opportunity now is to say, okay, what should we do with that? And we felt like it's really become more treated like a theater stage than it has as a sacred site of the restoration. So our plan is now to remove all of that infrastructure, which includes 21 buildings.
I was surprised that there's that many buildings that have come up because of that.
Restrooms for the cast and the
restrooms, I understand completely.
Yeah. Places to change costumes. And to run a show like that, it takes a lot of infrastructure. There's underground infrastructure for the lights and the water displays, and then there's 400,000 square feet of asphalt that needs to be pulled up, parking lots and trails and pads to support equipment. And so all of that will be removed. And the plan is to, over time, return the hillside to a forested hill. Now, we know when Joseph Smith went there in the 1820s, that part of that hill had been cleared on the north end. And so there were a lot of tree stumps around. We're not planning to cut down any more trees, but what we will do with that major lawn area is to reseed it with trees and allow those to start to grow up, and which will be better for the hill. We have significant erosion problems on that hill already. That hill is too steep to not have vegetation on it. And so we'll be able to stabilize that hill and take it back to a natural setting. So visitors will have an experience much like they have in the Sacred Grove, because they'll be able to wander on trails all over that hillside, some of which will be in old growth forest, which is what's on the south end of the hill. And then on this section that had once been cleared, it will. I jokingly say it's a bit like having a teenager. It will look a little unruly for a time until it grows up. And about 30 years, we'll have a beautiful forest there.
So the trails that will be installed, if I read correctly, will lead to the Angel Moroni Monument, which will still stay atop that hill, correct?
That's correct. So there'll be a couple of hills or a couple of trails that will still lead to the monument, but there are other trails that just wander through the vegetation on the hillside.
Okay. Let's stay on historic sites for just a bit, because the church is starting to reopen historic sites after the pandemic. Can visitors expect anything different when they go to the sites now than when they maybe used to, if some are returning, you know, to the sites?
So each of the sites will be in line with whatever local restrictions are in place. And we know in one state, you have to ask people if they have any COVID symptoms before they come into a facility. And so we'll be doing that. But for the most part, the masking guidelines have been removed unless you are have not been vaccinated. And so we're asking visitors to follow those guidelines from the CDC.
What about just their experience otherwise? We've heard talk about there'll be less like proselytizing and a little bit more historical explanations going on at the sites. Is that true? Is that what's going to happen a little bit?
So that's true. That's a change that's actually been happening for a couple of years. And that's because for many years, the historic sites were operated by the missionary department, because church leaders really viewed them as an opportunity to proselyte. But the reality is most of the visitors to historic sites are members of the church. Mm-hmm. And so a few years ago, as the missionary department tried to kind of refocus their efforts, they said, maybe we shouldn't be running historic sites. And so church leaders decided to transfer the operations to the church history department. And so our focus is really on members of the church, helping them understand church history, and anyone else who's, of course, welcome to come to the sites. And so the focus is more a church history focus, looking at building understanding and building faith, and helping people connect with the past and with the place, rather than on a goal of proselyting.
So both of you, can you speak to what will you take away from this meeting? Lessons for future meetings? Barbara, you said probably always do some hybrid, some online stuff. Jenny, as president, what did you guys learn?
Can I talk about one session that was a highlight for me? It's kind of going back to the earlier question, sure. And then I'll answer yours, because I don't want to not talk about this session. But there was a session titled Living African American History, and we had four African American panelists talk about who are Latter-day Saints, talk about their experiences. It was kind of an oral history session, talk about their experience and their family's experience in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So two of them were Robert and Alice Birch. That was phenomenal. Alice is a former Relief Society president of the Genesis Group. And Robert is head of the Utah chapter of the African American History and Genealogical Society. And then we had the third person was, in fact, you guys ought to have him on your show, Charles Andrew Smith, who is the grandson of Linda Brown of Brown versus Board of Education. Mm. And he is a Latter-day Saint. His parents are Latter-day Saints, and his grandmother Linda was not a Latter-day Saint, but he talked about what her feelings were about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and apparently she loved President Hinckley, and anyways, he talked a lot about her and what she was like, and just their family's experiences. And then Taryn Mitchell got up, and she was the commentator on the session. Taryn works for the Church History Library, where one of the things she does is to collect Black oral histories. And Taryn got up and commented on everybody's papers. And then when she got to Andrew, she said, Andrew, I want to tell you what your family has meant to my family. She said, my people come from North Carolina, South Carolina. My great-grandmother was a slave. My grandparents were sharecroppers. My mother attended school in a one-room segregated schoolhouse in which they closed curtains to have separate classrooms. Because of your grandmother, Andrew, and your great-grandparents, my mom became the first in my family's history to go to a non-segregated school. Both of my parents became the first in my family's history to go to traditional colleges, not historic Black, HBCUs, historic Black colleges and universities, but just a regular college. They went on to become highly educated. My father became a football coach. He coached at Wake Forest, Ohio University, and I forgot the third one, UNC. Sorry if I get that wrong, Taryn. But he coached at three different universities where he coached hundreds of Black athletes who were also able to go to college. Myself and my siblings have all become highly educated and are working in our professions. And then she said, "That's all, Andrew, because of your family. And I just want to thank you and your family for what you have done for my family." And the whole time she's sharing all of this, Andrew, his mic was still on. He kept saying, "Wow, wow, wow." And so anyways, everyone in the room was really moved. It was a fabulous moment, one that will stand out in my mind as a key moment in MHA history. So I did want to talk about that. Okay, going forward, what have we learned? Again, a silver lining of COVID. This has taught us how to do a digital conference along with in-person at the same time. We have been talking for years at MHA about how we increase our global outreach, how we increase our diversity, how we get more participation from people who might not be able to afford to get on a plane and fly to wherever our conference site is. We have learned this is the way we do it. We love how much participation we have. We've also had a lot of people learning about MHA for the first time because of our digital conference. And again, I encourage everyone listening, if you'd like to listen to all of these sessions we've been talking about, you can either listen or watch them online. And again, just visit MormonHistoryAssociation.org. But I think going into the future, we're really going to be increasing our diversity and our outreach. And I'm so excited about that.
So you mentioned that you plan to return or try to go to Rochester in 2023, the one you had to cancel, right, from last year. So talk about that.
So just when Jenny was talking about the Hill Camorin and rehabilitating it as part of this new project, I'm so excited because we will get back to Rochester. We are going to Logan in 2022, Logan, Utah. But in 2023, we will be going to Rochester and doing the conference that we planned a few years ago. And what's exciting is now, again, another silver lining of COVID, this time we'll be able to go and visit that rehabilitated site at the Hill Camorra. Hmm.
Jenny, what about you? What are your takeaways from this conference?
So I'll just say amen to everything Barbara did about the opportunity to go digital and global. I think that's a really critical step for MHA to take. And I think the other part is maybe the opposite of that, and that is how important reunion is. There was just this jubilant feeling to be able to get together, to see people you hadn't seen in a long time, to sit down and talk history. You know, and if you're an isolated scholar somewhere, you don't have that opportunity very often. And there was a lot of great conversations going on, a lot of joy, a lot of people taking selfies with each other. And it was like 10 times more than just at a usual conference. And so there was a lot of celebration around that factor. So even though we want to go digital and we want a global story, the fact that it's still important for us to get together in the same room when it's possible and make those connections with one another.
So one last question. Next year in Logan, the president-elect is Claudia Bushman, who is 87 years old. How are you going to engage? You know, everyone loves Claudia. This is not a dig on her. But how will you engage younger historians and scholars in MHA?
I'll start with that, and Jenny can jump in as well. So as a board of directors, we always in our board meetings discuss future presidents, and we were all kind of lamenting once that Richard Bushman had been president of MHA like in 1977 or something like that, and we were lamenting the fact that Claudia Bushman had never been asked. And then all of the younger scholars on our board were saying, well, let's ask Claudia. And then the older scholars on the board, myself included, were saying, guys, we can't do that to her. She will be, by the time she goes off the board, she'll be 89 years old. We can't do that to her. She won't say yes. But the younger scholars kept insisting that we ask Claudia. So we took a vote and the vote came out for Claudia. And so Ignacio Garcia, who was president of the MHA at the time, I remember we were talking and he was one of the older scholars that said, she'll say no. I said, well, we need to ask her and she can tell us no, but let's at least ask her. And then he called her and then he called me back and he said, Barbara, she said yes. And so we were all absolutely thrilled. But again, it was the younger scholars who said, we've got to ask her. And I think with everyone at MHA, Claudia Bushman, Richard Bushman, they are icons in the Mormon History Association. And so they're people that we look up to as people who have tread the path before us. And so actually, it's our younger scholars, I think, who are most excited about having Claudia as president. And then we were surprised again when Claudia asked Richard Bushman to be one of our program committee co-chairs, because typically program committee co-chairs are students, are younger people. And then we got the renowned Richard Bushman, who's going to be program committee co-chair. And they asked Christine Hagland, who is a younger scholar, to be another co-chair. And she's fantastic. So I'm not at all worried about whether or not we will be engaging younger scholars going forward. Jenny, did you want to add anything?
I'll just add that Claudia spent her career, like I have, in public history, and she loves to put on a big show or a big event. She planned centennial celebrations and bicentennial celebrations along the East Coast for various groups. And so she knows how to do it and to do it well and how to involve the community. And next year's conference is really going to be fabulous.
And I learned that. I went up to Logan with the Bushmans the day before MHA started, 2 days before MHA started, to start planning MHA 2022. And somebody there said, you know, we ought to have like this string quartet. There's a famous composer from Logan, and he had written a piece for a quartet, and then also he had written choral pieces as well. And so I said, well, why don't we have this 4-person string quartet play at our opening reception? That would be kind of neat, you know, have that in the background. And Claudia said, why don't we have Craig Jessup, former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, who now lives in Logan and directs the American Heritage Choir up there. No, we're going to have at our opening reception Craig Jessup direct this full-on choral piece, and we're going to do it in the Danes Conference Hall on Utah State University and we will fill the conference hall with 1,700 people. So that is Claudia's vision of what we're going to do for our new opening reception. So just relating to that, it's going to be phenomenal with the Bushman's sweeping vision. I'm excited about it.
Well, we'll look forward to that. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that young historians would have their eye on historians too, right? They're used to looking at the past and that. So Barbara Jones Brown, Jenny Lund, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having us on. It's been a pleasure.
And be well and stay safe, okay?
Thanks, you too.
And thanks to Peggy Fletcher Stack.
Always a pleasure.
And to our producer, Chris Samuels, we remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to the Salt Lake Tribune's free Mormon Land newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next time on Mormon Land.